That's great with the color. Go ahead, Kevin. Okay, hold it in. This is, so Murray's the eighth, Murray, Mr. Murray wrote a history of Delaware County, 1897, and said this was at least 70 years old in 1897. So that means it was built at least as of 1827, if not earlier. And it's this part. This two-story addition was added in 1885. And the small building, that's the Murrow Art Gallery, used to be attached here. There's a photo in the book I know about it. They moved this off and they built this. This is 1885. Remember, the railroad comes to Hobart in 1884. And as we'll see briefly later, there was a building explosion in the 1880s after the railroad came here. So the hotel sold, and the new owner did a lot of renovation work on it. And at some point, I don't have it here, he had the first running water in all the hotel rooms in any hotel in Delaware County. Like, I think 1887 maybe. Well, it was after the village water system was built. It was late 1880s. But, so the hotel dates, back to the 1820s, at least. I think there's another picture, Kevin. Yeah, okay. It's a little newer. And I think it's just, No, I didn't. George Foote sold it to his youngest son, Jeremiah, in 1818, the property. So, and George Foote dies 2 years later in 1820, but Jeremiah owned it. And it's possible there was a building here, but I'm wondering if it was 70 years old as of, like 1827. It was built sometime in the 1820s, is my present guess. Next. Okay, 698 Main Street. We all know this is a post office. It's used as a bookstore now. Barbara Ballier and Joe Clark have the bookstore. This was my father's drugstore for 30 years. We're talking about this building. It's there's a deed, March 1828 deed, that says William Trotter was living here in 1828. And so you got to think this part was added. So the roof came down like this. This wasn't here. This might have been. I don't know if that was there yet, but it's had a transformation through the years. So it could be as old. I've got it here. Yeah, by 1828 it was built. There's a reference. It was used then, I think, by a couple of people, houses. Then by the 1870s, John Olmsted, who lived across the street. Remember, we saw the old picture of the flower house with John Olmsted. He converted it into a carriage house or barn for his house right across the street. So for 40 years, it was a carriage house. Then John Gregory, who lived across the street, who owned it, converted it into a store. Hardware store, and sold it to Edson Hogue. Edson Hogue, it was George Flower's first business operations in the 1920s before he moved up the street. And George, I believe George built this as a garage, the post office, in the 1920s, and then it became the post office in 1948. But the building has been there a long time, the basic part of the building. They had a cupola on top and some old pictures, which is neat. Next. Okay. Yeah, do the next one too. This is 278 River Street. That's the present. Yeah, do the next. Yeah, it's a little. This is an older picture. It's sort of interesting. Just go back. Can you just? Yeah. Okay. See. So this is River Street in Pearl. This is This used to be an old boarding house and a restaurant through the years. But go ahead, Kevin. Back to the older picture. Yeah. But it was a house. This was the Jesse Beers house that I mentioned in the beginning. This was the one that the 1901 article said may have been one of the oldest houses. But as best I can tell, and I think I've given you the information, Jesse Beers paid $100 in 1830 for this. And he sold it 15 years later for $800. And I don't think there was a house there when he bought it. It was the Andrew Beers owned it. It was in the Beers estate. So I think it was just an open lot. The lot itself is on the 1801 map that we have of the village. But I don't think the house, so that's why I think the 1901 article that said Jesse Beers, and then the 1905 article said Andrew Beers. I think Andrew was right across the street, was probably more correct. But it's a beautiful old house, and it's two or three apartments now, I think. Okay. This is East Main Street. This is Marge and Valkenberg's house. Those of you know Marge. This was originally on Main Street next to the Hobart Inn, going towards Stanford, so if you face it to the right. And it was owned by J.B. Rich, James B. Rich, who had the general store. And here's an error. I say 1910 in the outline. It's 1906. Sorry, but I... Mr. Rich wanted to build a new house on Main Street. That house is still there on Main. It's right across from the Liberty Rocks bookstore. It's not in the greatest shape these days. But it was a brand new house that the Riches built, J.B. Rich built in 1906. So he moved half of his old house here. Get through the next picture. So this was an early picture of it. And this is, so that if you're on East Main, the two barns are right next to it here. As you go out, the old Mason barns, the two barns are there. But that's after it was moved. The Riches lived there in the summer of 1906 while the new house was being built. But that, because of that, this part of the house probably dates back to the early 1830s. It was a lot next to the Hobart Inn, sold in 1832. And then the owner built a house and had a tin shop, tin business there.
So instead of being moved in 1910, you said it was moved in 1906?
Yes, right. Sorry, I noticed that later. Yeah. Moved in 1906. Okay, next. Yeah, yes, Bill.
The little album there on the table of Hobart Scenes, that was published by J.B.
Yes.
Rich, put together by J.B. Rich.
Yeah, he was
in Buffalo.
Right? Yeah, J.B. Rich had, as old as you know, and he had the Grand. It was the old Grand Union store. It was right on. It was down the street from Adams Bookstore, right at the bridge, as across the river, right on the corner, right almost right across from the coffee pot on the other side of the road. And it was a general store. J.B. Rich, his father, started it in the 1860s, 1870s. Robert Rich. J.B. had it. I mean, he got Kodak cameras, and he did a lot of photography and started selling a lot of the postcards you see from the early 1900s have his name on the back, and he was selling them of the early days of Hobart. So I just found the deeds. I mean, he died. J.B. Rich died, let's say, in the 1940s, 1930s, but his estate owned the Grand Union right up till... It never got sold until like the night. I think the village took over in like 1970 when it was still there when I was a kid. So, but it never got out of the estate for some reason. Okay, Kevin. Here we go. Yes, this is 96. My outline says Maple Street. Obviously, Maple Avenue. Sorry. This one's got me. I'm not sure. There's been a house. This is. Right next to the Presbyterian Church. I don't know, was there another picture? Back.
Yeah.
One more?
Okay.
Back? Yeah, that's it. This is a little bit older, but this is what it looks like now. It's an apartment building. I don't know. I have trouble believing it's as old as the 1830-something. But it's possible because there's been people there constantly and it's been sold through the years, and that's why, go ahead. This was older, this was a nice old picture. A lot of these places all had beautiful porches that all disappear. But this is, Sheldon Hanford owned this in the 1880s and the 1900s, and his daughters, Peace Hanford, Frances, and according to Wally Rich, I don't think Wally's here today, is he? Wally Rich, so he found his father, said the first automobile in Hobart was owned by Alex Avery. Alex lived here. So the first automobile was there. The lot was sold off in 1833, so the house could have been built sometime around that time. Next. This is This is now at 560 Pearl Street. This is going out of the village. This is just outside the village line on Pearl, going out the back road to Stanford. But this house was located at 150 Maple, basically across from the bank. It was the Orrin Griffin house. Probably could have been built in the 1830s. Orrin bought the property in 1833, and it was lived there for 15, 20 years. And so the Hanfords. The Hanfords bought the property. The Hanford had the house moved and built a new house. So this was on the property where Main Advance is now, sort of across the street from the bank. But this would be an older house from the 1830s, just outside the village. As you go outside the village on the right-hand side. Next. 115 River Street. Now, this is, I don't think Doris is here today. She has it. No. 4 years, we put out the book, 2012, 2013. I think it was the last year of the Horseshoe Festival. Summer of 2014, Doris Clark came up to me. Doris Clark lives here with her daughter and her husband. Said, you know, I've heard my house was moved. The house I have was moved to my location. I said, I've not ever heard that. But I'll watch, and I still got to send her something. I found, and I don't still know 100%, but I found references to an article in the 1885. This was that a house was moved off the corner of, well, basically what's 245 River Street, where Kathy and George live today, next to Mill Street, the old Mill Street. Ed Barlow owned it at the time and had built a new house. And his old house was moved off and moved down the street to a lot across from the fairgrounds, roughly. This isn't quite it. And I think it's this house. Now, it's probably been modified and added, but this, if so, it would make it. And so I've got to let them. I mean, Doris told me, so I found some articles that said that, and I have to write to her and let her know that I think she's right about it. And then it would have come from, if it's that, it would be that old. It would have been built possibly in the 1830s by Abraham Bush, I think, and then moved in 1885. There might be another picture of this one, Kelly. Yeah, okay, that's newer. Yes?
Did you take that picture, the previous picture, did you take that one?
No, or, I think is Robert here? Mr. Steed took this one.
Is that the road there? See the tree with the dealing star?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably the edge.
Yeah.
That's River Street.
Because today, that road has been built up considerably.
I don't think the next one shows. I took the next one. Yeah, no, I didn't. Okay. Before we did the book, we had Robert Steed, who's here today, went around the village and took a whole bunch of pictures of all the houses. We used a lot of them in the book, and I still keep track of which ones he took. So I'm pretty sure that first one was one of his. But yes.
Do we know why all these houses were moved? It's amazing. I mean, today we don't move houses around this way.
Yeah, that just shows you there was value and. There's 15 or 20 that were ultimately buildings that were moved through the years.
We don't know why.
Well, just probably the building had value and somebody bought it, moved it, didn't have to build a new thing. I can't find, the problem I'm having with this is it was moved, the family that bought this property bought it a couple years after the house was moved here, if the dates all are correct. And I don't know why, so it was moved. The family that owned, at that time, the family that owned this lived on West Main Street. On the other side of Mill Street. They owned the whole north side of River Street from the old Betts house, from the Hanford house up to DeWitt's house. And they started selling the lots off in the 1880s. But somehow this house got moved in 1885, and the lot didn't get sold in 1887. And the next two lots, we're not going to be in there. We're sold, and there are stories about the houses being built. There's no story about this house being built on this property at that time, which makes me think that it was moved there. Because I did that, there's an article about it being moved. Okay. Back to Main Street. 634 Main. This is the old blue and white restaurant. Apartment building. Now it's right across from the Hobart Inn. And I had an inquiry a couple years ago from the real estate agent, I think, when they were selling, trying to sell it. We thought it was the oldest building in the village. I said, no, not quite, but it is, it may be the oldest. I think it's maybe the oldest along Main Street, certainly in this part of Main Street. This lot was, the lot, the land was owned by the hotel until 1835, and it was sold off. There was a reference in 1835 that there was a shoe shop here on this lot. So the building may have been there by 1835. Maybe another picture of this one, Kevin, I'm not sure. Oh yeah, this is an older, it was a barber shop. After the book came out, I got an email from a Kellerman descendant, because we had Kellerman in the book in the barber shop, and he was amazed to see the picture of it. But that's the building in the early 1900s, with the barber pole. And it became the Occursals owned it. Okay. Hey, 235 Pearl, 60 Cornell. This is, right here. Right behind us here. This was built as a Methodist church in 1835. That's why, I mean, you got the, you can see the features of the church. And this is on Cornell now, it's right behind us here. It was moved in 1885. The church, with the Olmsted family helping, decided to build a new church 50 years later. This building was bought. And I found various articles in it was either the Hobart Independent or the Delaware Gazette newspaper. It was moved during the summer of 1885. Initially, it was moved from it was at the present Methodist Church, which is Maple Avenue. It was moved across the street, maybe Kitty Corner, to the corner, and used as a church somewhat. Then it was moved around, however, to the base of the hill over here, Sheffield's house, Cornell, where the Mallinckrodt Building 16 is. Was moved there. Then it got moved, and the big deal was, by then in 1885, the railroad tracks were here. Yeah. And the story is, that they needed permission. This I never understood, but now they needed permission to move it across the railroad tracks. Well, in those days, the railroad tracks were this far above the road. I mean, there was no right of way right here on Cornell to go across the tracks. The road ended right here at the railroad depots, and it was a railroad yard for the three or four sections of tracks. And then it started again across as Cornell went up the hill. So the story is, through the years, is that Mr. Grant, R. Hume Grant, that bought it, knew that they'd never get permission to move it. So he went down anyway to the railroad in Kingston, the offices, to ask for him. And while he was there asking for permission, the building got moved at night. And of course, the railroad said no, but then it was already in, so they said that they aren't going to have them take it back over the track. This is an apartment building now. I don't know, four or five apartments, but it was moved here. It became the village hall and the community center, opera. I think there's one more picture, Kevin. Yeah, it's a little. This part was added a few years later. It was moved here in 1885. This was added tried a stage for an opera house. And so and some people here will know there were movies here in the 1930s, 20s, 40s. There's stories of basketball games being played in there. And it was really, the hardware. E.T. Van Buren bought it. Maybe Van Buren's hardware. I remember going in looking at little John Deere tractors and things in there. It was a hardware store, and then some other appliances, and then an apartment building.
It's unusual to move them during the summer.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They'd use the frozen ground, easier to pull it.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you have a lot of free labor during the winter. They can't be out plowing.
Right. I'll have to look at that. That's a good time. Yeah. That's the end of the pictures. Yeah. Yes, Barbara.
I heard that in the basement of that there was a shop down there as well.
Yeah, go back to the other one. Move back one, Kevin.
There's a red door down in the lower level.
Yeah, yeah. So,
there was a meat shop?
Grocery store. This was one of the main grocery stores.
That was Hoyt's store.
Hoyt's.
And before that was Thompson's.
Yep.
Up Maple Avenue.
Yeah, it's a good point. Right after he opened this up as sort of like the village hall, he had a grocery store down there, and it operated for 40 years or so as a grocery store.
I think my dad was.
And then he, yeah, he moved the grocery store to Adams Bookstore. Because it was Hoyt's store in the garage. The building next door was Hoyt's garage through the 40s and 50s. But yes, that's a good point, but yep.
And just to be clear, it was the church that was moved, not the parsonage. Your paper says parsonage.
Oh, gosh. See, I was trying to do too much at once. Yes, you're right. Excuse me. No, wait.
No, that's the next one.
Yeah, I got the wrong picture. That's the next one. Yeah, no, we got one more to go. Excuse me. We got one more to keep going.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, no, thank you. I got mixed up. This is the last one, circa 1833. So this is next to the, this was the old Methodist Church parsonage. Now, I think built in the 1830s by John Olmsted. He bought the lot next to the church, so where the present parsonage is. He bought that lot in 1836. The church was already there in 1835, the building we just saw. And so he built this house. He later moved to River Street, 1850s, and ultimately the church bought this building in like 1856 or something. And then they decided to build a new parsonage in 1903. Mm-hmm. And this got moved. Now, this was moved in the winter. This was moved December. It took a month to move like half a block. because it was over. You see, I think this may be the current parsonage, the back. Let's just move from there over. They built a cellar for this here. And it's been there since 1903. George Stevens lived there for many years, George Stevens family. Okay.
Jim?
Yes?
Now, in the book on page 117, you keep saying the Hobart Inn, but the two pictures on the right listed as the commercial house.
Yeah, I'm talking in a lot of present terms, but yes, yeah. it was the commercial house in the 1880s. Then at some point it became the town tavern, maybe when the specials bought it. I'm still, it's a little hard, but yes, I'm sorry. Yes, it was a commercial house when the Weeks family owned it. A lot of the time, when you go further back, it's the names of the owners, Stevens Hotel or whatever. It gets very hard to follow. And sometimes the name is not the owner, it's the person operating it. They didn't actually own it, but yes. And I'm going to have... I forget, I may have a lot more information in the new book on some of those things and with the dates and so forth. I mean, now that's...
It was beautiful, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Let me... Yes?
Was there any fire history here? I mean, how did these all survive? Time and people, I don't...
No, that's a good question. Actually, with some of the other ones in my outline, newer ones, there have been fires, like the coffee pot. You know, if we kept going, the coffee pot was... I think built in the 1850s, but as we know, that was basically gutted in the, I forget, 2000 something, and rebuilt. So yeah, I've tried. That's harder to find out. I mean, because I don't have, you got to come across a newspaper article sometimes, and while Hobart will be covered, the Hobart Independent was great. I mean, the Hobart Independent operated from 1885 to about. Like it's 1910, 1920, got bought by the Stanford Mirror, basically. And so, and as you go out, as you get away from it, they don't cover the local stories as much. Unfortunately, with the Hobart Independent, we only have 5 years, maybe 8 years of the 30 years that was published. There's a lot of blank space, and then the Stanford Mirror is not as accessible in the early 1900s. There is some of it, but there are some years that are missing. And then, then it becomes the Oneonta Daily Star, through the 30s and 40s with the Mirror. It's fine. But it's very hard to figure out what fires. I've tried, but it's hard. Yes?
You mentioned the Grand Union store was in the J.B. Rich estate until the 70s. Now, when we were kids, Spencer Sheehan had the Grand Union store, but he never owned the building. Just ran the business.
He ran the business. He had the business. He didn't own the building. It'll be in the new book. I found it because I was surprised. But no, it didn't. It kept running. And he didn't. I think it. it stayed in the estate right until the village bought it when they tore it down, which is, yeah.
Didn't Jamie Rich own, well, there was a gas pump just around the corner, and didn't he have a little gas station there in his older years?
Yeah, there was, yes.
Name and Jeff above.
Yes. Yeah, and we got a good picture for the new book with the gas station. It shows part of the gas station, but I'm not as familiar with that. I didn't find it, but the piece of property was all part of the store. The Grand Union store. That's the end of the pictures. I'm happy to, oh yes, Don.
Can we assume that there were houses here in Hobart before 1800? Because why else would they build a church that size here?
Yes, no, we can assume, yeah, there were houses.
Yeah.
Yes.
They may have been pretty primitive.
Right, right.
Log cabins, right. And that sort of temporary.
Well, and also the St. Peter's Church, it's amazing, the St. Peter's Church, I mean, the original name was St. Peter's Church of Stanford, Harpersville, and Courtright. As you know, I mean, you know, we talked about it, if you go back and look in the days of 1800, the town line for Harpersville and Courtright ran right into Hobart. The river separated. Stanford was on this side of the river. That side, if you cross, that side was Harpersfield, if you cross over now, and Courtright at about Mill Street, just up the hill past. So there were three towns here, and the village initially was in three towns. And in 1834, they took over the land from Harpersfield and Courtright, basically from roughly Breezy Acres, just past Gunhouse Hill Road, incorporated into Stanford. But so the initial congregation was from the three towns, and people traveled from quite a ways. But yes, there were houses. It's just none of them really survived in terms of being old, except the barber's house, basically, and the church. But there were, and you can see, if you go and look, I mean, I've looked through the census records. It's very hard, and they're not, you can't rely completely on the census records, but you'll see people living and everything. We're a little bit over. I'll run quickly through the rest. I don't have any more pictures, but I'll run just quickly a couple highlights on the rest of it. Anybody, is that all right? You've got 5-10 minutes. Everybody all right with that? I wanted to just, on page 5, just the second one after, we're in the 1840s. The second one, this is Don Dale's house, 1841, 1842. This was the Horace Hanford house. But it was across the street. At the O'Connor residence house, and they got moved in 1922. So the O'Connors could build a new house, and this house was there. Let's see, I don't know how much. The top of the next page 6, I was gonna, there's a lot of talk about the school that Jay Gould attended, but it's 300 Maple Avenue. It was basically, I've since found an article, the frame of the house was used to build the house that's there now. It was originally built up near the Episcopal Church in the 1846. It got moved down to the upper dam area to be a blacksmith shop in the 1860s. And then the article says the frame was used in 1885 to build the house that's there now at 300 Maple Avenue. But there is a connection to Jay Gould with that. The next one, Barbara and Bill Coleman's house, 930 East Main, is interesting. That probably is from the mid-1840s. It might be a little bit earlier than that. It was an open lot, I think, up to 1836. J.W. Taylor bought it in 1836. His family lived, he was living at that time right at the Van Cleek farm. And he moved on. The articles say that he, when he got married in 1845, he moved to the house there on East Main, to the farm. So I'm guessing that the house was built sometime around that time, as he got married and he moved there. Two houses on River Street, this is, I mentioned earlier, 250 River Street was 12 acres. So 224, that's the old Hoy house. Yes. Kaufman's. That was sold off. Robert Wilson paid $373 in 1847, sold it for $1,700 5 years later. So I'm pretty certain that he probably built the house there. And 196 next door, that's the Braemar Court with the trailer park. Same thing, lot was sold off in 1847. Lavinius Munson was an attorney. I can't find when he sold, he died, but I can't find the sale of it, but he bought it for $450. Way at the bottom, I gotta mention Adam's bookstore. Bottom of page six, when I started this, I honestly thought Adam's bookstore was gonna be in the top 25. Just in my thought, but it's down here a little ways. It was on, and the one right before, the last two, 622 Main, that was Vin Cantwell's place, and 602 Main, Adams. There was a wool factory, the Foote family, George Foote again, the oldest son, Bailey Foote, ran the wool factory and then turned it over to Charles Booth, remember the Booth house? And the wool factory operated there from 1799 to a big fire in 1847, completely burned down. It's where the Hobart Market store is, Vin Cantwell's building, and Adams Bookstore, and it went even further down the street toward the bridge. Adams Bookstore was the dye house for the wool factory. The wool factory completely burned down. It was bought by Orrin, the lot was bought by Orrin Griffin in 1849. I think the Cantwell house was built maybe early 1850s, and at least now I think the Adams Bookstore, there's a reference in an 1875 deed that William Foote built the building. And as of 1860, there was a hardware store there operated by William Foote. 1856, he was across the street on the Gould map. He's across the street on the Gould. So I think he moved sometime 1857 to 1860. That's the coffee pot we talked about. Just the very last page. We talked about this a few years ago, 1880s, when the railroad came. Just, if you look, I mean, there were 9 buildings added in the 40s, 9 in the 50s. All of a sudden in the 1880s, 33 buildings built. And if you look closely, it's like 1884 to 1889. It's like a 5-year period. And it's all after the railroad came here. And it just shows you the impact the railroad had. This Cornell Avenue that we're on was a new street that opened up. There's a railroad, the depots are right out here. And interestingly, under Cornell, 40 Cornell Avenue, that's the funeral home. It's neat to note that there's been a funeral home there continuously since March 1st of 1887. Mm-hmm. Probably the oldest, certainly the oldest private business operating continuously. East Main, various lots were sold off and houses built. Main Street, there had been a big fire in January of 1884, it's in the book. Five buildings across the street from Adams's, the five buildings across the street from the coffee pot down almost to the Hobart Inn, burned. And so they had rebuilding there, and two buildings that are still left, 607, 615 Main, were built at that time. Let's see, anything? High Street, Church Street, I know we have Mr. Steed here from High Street. Abraham Silliman was the big carpenter. He built a lot of the buildings in the village. He built the three houses on High Street, 1888 to 1889, and then he built the three houses on Church Street. He built them before, 1887, 1888. It's hard to tell. I was just talking to Mr. Steed before this. I don't know the order that the three houses were built. You know, you got three of them there. The middle one is probably the middle one, but anyway, the first one was built in the fall of 1888, and the last one by the summer of 1889. Finally, I know T. Gould's here from 170 River Street, the Hobart Fairgrounds. Fascinating to look. I'm still looking at this. 170 River, it's right down there, down River Street. From the 1850s to 1889, it's the Hobart Fairgrounds. And they had the competition. They would hold, we had the county fair. The Delaware County Fair was here 3 or 4 times in the 1860s, and they would put it up for bid every year to see, and the people that bid had to guarantee the highest return in the county or whatever. It's fascinating, just the blurbs in the papers. Hobart got into it for a while. I mean, before it settled in, is it Walton now? Walton. But then Hobart continued to have its own fair. So then for a few years there'd be 2 fairs. And it's a big, now, it just amazes me, it's not in the outline, September 9th, 1887, what do you have? 4,000 people attended the fair. 4,000. I mean, the village now is 400 people. 4,000 people at the fair. Now, there's no cars. This is all, the train is here, so they're calling by train or they're calling by horse and buggy.
And T's great uncle, Gene Story, showed me where the racetrack used to be around his garden there.
Thank you.
As a kid, he showed me that.
So, yeah, it's still, so that, there's stories about the big racetrack.
Yeah.
And David, that's the only, so Gene Story owned the house later. Well, David, if you look at it now, there's an open lot, there's a house, and then there's a lot next to it. It's all part of the property, but that's where the racetrack was, right? From River Street going to the railroad track?
Of course, now it's all level where it used to be level.
Right.
That was.
That's, apparently, I've not heard that, but that's what Gene Story said, the racetrack was there. The railroad expanded in 18, so the railroad came here in 1884, and then immediately decided to expand onto South Courtright, Boomba, ultimately to Oneonta, the Ulster and Delaware Railroad from Kingston. They started the expansion work in 1887. D.C. Sharp, who was referring, who owned the fairgrounds, but by this time had moved down to a farm outside, the Andrews Farm outside of South Courtright, was very upset. And he held up the expansion of the railroad for a couple of years, trying to get higher, better compensation for his land. But basically, the railroad went through the fairgrounds. So if you think about it today, the house on 170 Main Street and then across, on the other side of the railroad now is Hobart Village Water. There's two Eklund Wells. They're called Eklund Wells out there. It's about 10, 12 acres of land before you get to Town Brook. But the fairgrounds went out back in there. And there's some fascinating, I've read some references, I think Delaware Gazette, said that the Stanford photographer, Mr. Cornell, took pictures one year. And I don't know, I mean, I'm still trying to see if I can hunt them. I've never seen them. In the 1880s, 1890s, pictures of the Hobart Fair. Baseball games, they would have balloon ascensions. That would be the big deal. Somebody get in a balloon and go up. But they had thousands of people. All in. That's it.
Whoa.
Anything? I want to thank the Adamson's Bookstore again for the lecture that we do. This is the 10th year I've done Hobart. It's great. It's really nice if you all take a little bit of time. It's fun to put the information together. But thanks for coming out. Thanks for the Adamses for sponsoring this.
Well, Jim, I forgive you for demoting the bookstore. Because your talks bring this interesting, fascinating, endearing past so close.
The other day, I just wanted to say,
thank you so much.
Today, anybody here, if you don't have a book, this is the hardcover edition. We sell it for $40. I'm offering it today for $20. Anybody who doesn't have a book and wants one, just a quick sale, or we'll get it to you. We're going to have the new one out hopefully in a year. I don't know. It's Jerry and I.
I know.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, my God.